Rick Thaler, Director. You hear first from Mr. Udishin.
Thank you, Your Honor. My name is Gary Udishin. I'm from Dallas, and I represent Mr. Smith. First of all, let me say that we are well aware of the burden that we have under ADEPA and the different presumptions that we must overcome. But to begin with, if I could, I'd like to just quote from Harrington versus Richter, where the Supreme Court said habeas corpus is a guard against extreme malfunctions in the state criminal justice system. And I would submit to the court that this is just such a case. And if I could, just to give the court a little of the context and background that leads us to where we are today, I think that will put it in the proper perspective as to why it meets that standard under Harrington. Your Honor, Mr. Smith was charged. He was charged under a statute in Texas concerning sexual activity between ministers or clergymen and members of their congregation. He was tried in state court in Dallas and initially had a hung jury. Was tried a second time, and the second jury convicted him, and he was sentenced to 10 years in the penitentiary. He had retained counsel for his trials, but after his second trial and his conviction, he was indigent, and the court appointed him a counsel for his appeal. The appellate counsel filed an Anders brief, and unfortunately, and we have this in the record, this particular appellate counsel, who was appointed on a lot of appeals in the Dallas state courts, had a habit of filing Anders briefs. And I think the statistics that we provided in the district court that are part of the record is that we located 68 cases filed by this particular attorney in the state court of appeals, the Dallas court of appeals, and 64 out of 68 were Anders briefs. So he filed an Anders brief in this case. Ultimately, the Court of Appeals denied the appeal based upon this counsel's Anders brief. We got involved on the filing of an 1107 writ in state court. One of the issues that we raised was ineffective assistance on appeal. The Dallas County District Attorney's Office appellate section agreed that Mr. Smith had received ineffective assistance on appeal and agreed to submit findings to the trial court, making that finding and recommendation to the Court of Criminal Appeals. The trial court agreed that he had received ineffective assistance on appeal, keeping in mind that this is the same trial court who tried the case and appointed this appellate lawyer. But she agreed, the trial judge agreed that, to the ineffective assistance on appeal. The case was sent down to the Court of Criminal Appeals, and the Court of Criminal Appeals remanded it back to the trial court asking for some additional information and additional findings concerning the ineffective assistance on appeal, which the trial court then provided, reaffirming the ineffective assistance on appeal. Then the Court of Criminal Appeals sent it back to the trial court asking for some additional findings and information concerning the other grounds in the writ. And then while the court was waiting for those findings and information to be provided to the Court of Criminal Appeals, the Court of Criminal Appeals just denied the writ, the application for writ of habeas corpus, without giving any reason, just saying that they had reviewed the record, they reject the trial court's findings, and that they deny the writ of habeas corpus. The result of that was that we wound up in federal court by filing a 2254 in the district court in Dallas. Ultimately,
did you ever get any findings?
I'm sorry?
You said it was sent back for findings and the appellate court ruled before they got it.
But they ruled before they got the second findings that they had requested from the trial.
Did you ever get those findings?
No, because the Court of Criminal Appeals had ruled and there was no necessity for it any further. Those findings, what they had asked for was some findings concerning ineffective assistance at trial, which was another issue on the writ. But they had received all the findings they had asked for on ineffective assistance on appeal. But nevertheless, they overruled all of the grounds raised in the writ. Ultimately, in federal court, the magistrate adopted the findings of the state trial. Well, I say findings loosely. They adopted the judgment of the Court of Criminal Appeals and then the district judge adopted the judgment of the magistrate. Ultimately, we filed a motion for reconsideration with the district court, and Judge Boyle held a hearing, wasn't really an evidentiary hearing, but just basically an argument between the attorneys to discuss the issue. And then she denied our motion for reconsideration, and that's what leads us to where we are today. Now, the issues, the particular issues concerning the ineffective assistance really boils down to, and I understand, I'm going to try to put this in the ADEPA context because I understand that's what this court has to do. But the question is, obviously, whether or not there was an unreasonable application of Supreme Court precedent or an unreasonable determination of the facts in light of the evidence. And under the circumstances of this case, on the ineffective assistance on appeal, our argument is that both of those provisions are met. And to begin with, the beginning point is, and we've cited plenty of cases, and there's really no dispute about this, that the Strickland test applies to ineffective assistance on appeal. No question about that. The Strickland test applies to ineffective assistance on appeal when the appellate counsel files an Anders brief, such as we have here. So the issue is, and Judge Boyle in the district court agreed, and I don't think anybody has seriously contested that this was deficient performance, that this appellate counsel appointed by the trial court filing an Anders brief was clearly deficient performance. There is no question, and I don't think that you're going to hear any serious argument from the state, that this was not a case that was appropriate for an Anders brief. And quite the contrary, this was a case that cried out for a merits brief because there were clearly substantial, important issues that needed to be presented. But for whatever reason, and I have my own theories as to the reasons, but for whatever reason, this particular lawyer who made a habit of filing Anders briefs chose to file one in this case. But so everybody agrees that was inappropriate. So it's the second prong of Strickland that we're really talking about, which is essentially the harm prong. And the harm prong under Strickland, of course, means that that we must show there's a reasonable probability of a different outcome. That does not mean, and there was some confusion in the court below, particularly we contend the magistrate's findings, as to whether or not that means that Mr. Smith has to show that had his issues been raised on a regular appeal, that the Court of Appeals would have reversed his case. That is not what that means. The reasonable probability, just as in any other Strickland context, simply means was confidence undermined in the outcome of the case. So the issue is whether or not the filing of an Anders brief in this case undermines confidence in the question as to whether or not Mr. Smith had a fair appeal. The case law concerning ineffective assistance in the context of an Anders brief, and we've cited cases from several different circuit courts and Supreme Court and from this court also, is the clearest test is, were there significant and obvious issues that should have been raised on appeal? And if the issues not raised could have possibly resulted in a reversal, the failure was prejudicial. Now, we've identified three issues in this case that should have clearly been raised on appeal and clearly made this case inappropriate for an Anders brief. The one that's been talked about the most in the briefing is the constitutionality of this statute. One that's been talked about less in the briefing, but it's just as important, is the sufficiency of the evidence in this case. And let me just spend a few minutes talking about the sufficiency of the evidence in this case.
Now, what would be the remedy? I mean, are we looking at these issues that you're talking about on the merits as to whether we would overturn it because there's insufficient evidence, or as you say, we would say, well, maybe there's an argument there that there was insufficient evidence, so it goes back for a new habeas to be filed in state court or federal court?
Your Honor, what the remedy is and what we're asking for is a new state appeal. And so we're not asking this court on the context of ineffective assistance on appeal to rule that these issues were winners and that should have been, that would be reversed on appeal. Because the way, I mean, from my looking at all the case law on ineffective assistance in the context of an Anders brief, I think it's sort of like a continuum where you have, there's some cases that use the terminology of dead bang winner. That clearly a lawyer that doesn't raise a dead bang winner point of error in his brief is ineffective. And then on the other end of the continuum, you have frivolous points, which is what you have in an Anders context, and which is what this lawyer said here, was that there are only frivolous points.
But how do we review these three issues that you say should have been raised?
The question for this court is, were they significant and obvious issues that should have been raised, that the failure to raise them undermines confidence in the outcome of the appeal?
So it's significant and what was your...
Significant and obvious.
Significant and obvious.
Significant and obvious. That's the phrase.
In other words, we can't look at them and decide that they don't have any merit.
Well,
and throw him out on that, huh?
I don't think that's an appropriate. That's sort of what the magistrate did below. What the magistrate did was act like she was the state appellate court, and said these issues. I would overrule these issues if I was the state appellate court. But that's not the standard. The standard is, should they have been raised? Were they non-frivolous issues?
But if they're federal constitutional issues, and if we decide they don't have any merit. What, do we still send it back because it's a close question or it's arguable or what?
I believe that that's correct. That may not be exactly the way the cases phrase it, but I think that's just another way of saying, are they significant and obvious? It doesn't mean that this court has to say an appellate court is going to rule in favor of Mr. Smith on these issues.
No, we shouldn't go ahead and resolve it.
It's not necessary for this court to resolve the issues in order for us to prevail on our 2254.
And what's your authority for that?
Well, because it's the Supreme Court cases, it's Strickland, it's the Court of Appeals case. There's a case called Vargas out of this court that we've cited in our brief that uses the significant and obvious language. So the question for this court is not whether or not, like I said, these are dead-bang winners, but whether they're significant issues and whether it was ineffective for him not to raise the issues.
How do you put that together with the AEDPA standard about unreasonable determination?
Your Honor, under the AEDPA standard, this is an unreasonable determination because it has misapplied Strickland in the context of ineffective assistance on appeal on an Anders brief in particular. But it's an unreasonable determination and application of Strickland, as well as an unreasonable determination under the facts of the case. Because, of course, the Court of Criminal Appeals, we have no findings, we have no statement, and I understand it's not necessary. I suppose that the lower court, the trial court's findings, would play really no role here, but that's the only findings we have, and those are in our favor. But under AEDPA, you look at Strickland and you say, did the Court of Criminal Appeals properly apply that case law? And they didn't under any version, because the only way it would have been a proper application of Strickland would be if these were not significant and obvious issues. And since they were, he's entitled to a new appeal in state court. And just to be clear, what we're asking for and what we have always been asking for and what the state trial court agreed that we were entitled to was simply a new appeal to the Fifth District Court of Appeals, State Court of Appeals in Dallas, where the State Court of Appeals, without an Anders brief muddying the record, where the State Court of Appeals would make a decision on the merits of these issues. And that's the remedy that we're asking for, is for this court to grant our relief, and the ultimate relief would give us that appeal. This situation really cries out for relief because you have a case that everybody agrees was inappropriate for an Anders brief. Mr. Smith has never had a fair appeal. The Supreme Court case law requires him to have a fair appeal, and he wasn't given that because of the ineffectiveness of his attorney.
What is the particular point on which you say everybody agrees that this case did not get the appropriate appeal?
Everybody agrees, Your Honor. Judge Boyle stated this on the record, and I don't believe the state argues contrary, that this lawyer should not have filed an Anders brief.
Okay.
That's the point everybody agrees
on. But that's not a substantive issue about whether or not the state court decision is supportable.
Well, Your Honor, it's half of the decision. It's half of the Strickland test. So I'm bringing that up to show that everybody agrees that the state court decision was wrong on the first half of Strickland. So the only question is, were they wrong on the second half, the prejudice part?
And where in the Supreme Court dialogue do you come up with this as something that the Supreme Court has said is applicable in this particular case?
Your Honor, the Strickland test applies to appeals. And so applying Strickland to this appeal, which the Supreme Court has made clear is the appropriate test, and then the second part of the Strickland test being, was confidence undermined in the outcome, that particular ruling and state of law from Strickland is what I'm talking about. Okay, thank you.
Okay, thank you, sir. Mr. Geiser.
May it please the court, Doug Geiser for Director Rick Thaler. Because Section 2254D applies, Smith must show not only that the Court of Criminal Appeals decision was wrong, but that it was wrong beyond any possibility for fair-minded disagreement. He cannot do so. First, his overbreath claim fails because he has no due process right, and certainly no First Amendment right, to abuse his position to coerce consent to sexual activity. Second, his vagueness claim fails because Section 22.011 infringes on no constitutionally protected rights, and because, whatever the exact scope of the statute's meaning, Smith's conduct falls within its very core. Third, his Establishment Clause claim fails because Section 22.011 in no way involves the state in religious affairs or religious doctrine. Finally, some ineffective assistance claim fails because the arguments he says should have been raised are meritless. So I'd like to start by discussing the ineffective assistance claim and some of the points raised.
Now,
they're saying
that we don't get to the merits of those because they should have, the fact that there was a Andrews brief filed in itself was ineffective, that maybe these issues should have been raised on the state level, and here we are with those issues before us. How do we review those issues? Can we say there might be merit to them and not really look as to whether there is merit to them? This standard that he said of significant and obvious, where does that get us?
Sure, Judge Prado, I do take issue with the point made by my friend in opposition there. The Supreme Court in Cullen v. Pinholster, when talking about the prejudice prong, which is the one that's mostly in dispute, we don't concede deficient performance, but I would like to focus on prejudice. So to get to your question, the Supreme Court there said that, again, a reasonable probability is a probability sufficient to undermine confidence in the outcome, but that requires a substantial, not just conceivable, likelihood of a different result. And this court in Schetzel v. Cockrell held a court must determine the probable outcome of the appeal had counsel's performance not been deficient. So this court does have to look at the merits. And just as a couple examples that we cite in our brief in Rose v. Thaler, which was an AEDPA case considering an ineffective assistance of counsel at appeal issue, the court said that the state court did not unreasonably decide that there was no Strickland prejudice, where the law was at best unclear whether he would have won on appeal. And in Cossie, this court said that there was no unreasonable, there was not an unreasonable denial of the prejudice prong, where the petitioner may have won, but the court, the appellate court, the state appellate court, also may instead have ruled against him. So this court does have to examine the merits of an issue and decide whether under Strickland there is a substantial probability of him prevailing on appeal, and then has to put the AEDPA overlay on that and ask whether the state court unreasonably decided that there was no substantial probability of him prevailing. And so for the reasons we discuss in our brief, we believe that the claims are meritless and that there was no substantial probability of that he would have prevailed on appeal had these been raised. Just to address one more point on this issue, it does mention that the district attorney had agreed to the findings of ineffective assistance before the state trial court, but the district attorney has no special insight here. These are legal issues. The claims that Smith raises are legal issues, and whether they would have been meritorious on appeal are also legal issues that the DA just doesn't have any special insight into. Happy to answer any questions for the court about the merits of Smith's claims. Otherwise, we're happy to rest on the briefs, and we ask that the court affirm the judgment of the district court.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Geiser.
Thank you.
Mr.
Your Honor, let me just talk about the point, the sufficiency point as to why this is an issue that has a high likelihood of success on appeal. The statute says that it is a crime when the actor is a clergyman who causes the other person to submit or participate by exploiting the other person's emotional dependence in the clergyman's professional character as a spiritual advisor. So essentially, the state had to prove that the defendant was a clergyman acting in his role as a spiritual advisor and caused the complainant to engage in sexual contact with him because of her emotional dependency. What the evidence shows was that the complainant and the defendant were longtime personal friends, even though he acted as her clergyman. In a small church that they had that met in people's houses, they had a long-time personal friendship separate and apart from that relationship. That at the time that they engaged in sexual activity, he was not counseling her, she was counseling him. He was having personal problems, he was suicidal, he was having marital problems, he was going to her as his friend asking for her help with his problems. And that's the fact.
Wasn't that an issue for the jury to decide as to whether?
What did the jury decide on that issue?
Well, Your Honor, that's true. That's an issue for the jury to decide. But it's also an issue for the Court of Appeals to decide on a sufficiency analysis as to those are the undisputed facts. And when you have undisputed facts from a sufficiency analysis, the Court of Appeals in Dallas would be required to decide whether or not those facts meet the requirements of this statute.
The State Court of Appeals.
The State Court of Appeals.
What did the State Court of Appeals decide?
The State Court of Appeals accepted the Anders brief and dismissed the appeal. So the State Court of Appeals never addressed the merits of this argument, and that's all we're asking for, is that him be allowed to bring the merits of these arguments to the State Court of Appeals, and the ineffectiveness of his court-appointed appellate lawyer filing an Anders brief is what stopped him from being able to do that. And I would submit we have the constitutionality question, we have the other questions we have in the brief, but I would ask the court to look closely at this sufficiency question, because when you look at what the evidence is, and we've laid this all out in the briefs, you look at what the evidence is, and the evidence is that the defendant was the one being counseled by the complainant, not the other way around. And the law requires it to be the other way around for the evidence to be sufficient. So Mr. Smith was denied the rights that everybody has, which is to have a first appeal of right represented by a competent counsel. And the state court misapplied Strickland, and under those circumstances, we would submit that we meet the AEDPA standards. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, sir.